Thanks, Penelope. My name's Simon and I'm an addict.
Hey, Simon!
If you're new, I'd like to welcome you. I remember sitting in my first meeting and I was institutionalised, and the meeting was actually in an institution. And I remember seeing that these posters up on the wall and with the steps and the traditions, and what I saw was God with a capital G six times and a bit of other writing. And I was just waiting for the sound of a key and a lock and someone to pull a guitar out from under a chair, because that's what I thought was going to happen. Because that's what I arrived with, you know. I was full of fear, and I have a little anxiety today because there's a lot of you here. But I'm truly excited and humbled to be able to do something like this, you know, to try and offer back some of the experiences that I've gained since I've been in NA. The last time I used was the 19th of December 1985. Whoa. And actually it was that night, because I was woken up by a nurse to ask if I wanted a sleeping pill, which at the time seemed really annoying, because I'd managed to have that sleep just before a rattle starts. You know, you get a decent bit of sleep and then you wake up sick, and I then didn't sleep for 2 weeks. But that sleep just before getting sick was a really valuable piece of sleep, knowing that I was going to then go through a rattle. And she woke me up right in the middle of it to ask if I wanted something to help me sleep. But that's a while ago now, thanks for sharing. I really enjoyed what you said, and from the first time I went to my first meeting, I've never picked up either, and I feel really graced by that. You know, I don't quite know why. And the reality is that if I can do this, anyone can do this, really. And I mean that, you know, with as much humility as I can find, which those of you who know me is not really very much. I wish I had more. The problem I have is I have a bit too much self-esteem. I remember hearing someone say that in a meeting really early in my recovery, and I thought, that sounds like me. A little bit of background. My dad left when I was really little. I was six, and I thought it was my fault because I was bad. Because people told me I was naughty, and I thought my dad had left because I was naughty. But he had this disease, and it killed him. He was a diabetic, and he drank, and it killed him. And his brother died of this disease, and his mum died of this disease. And you know, there's a clue in there somewhere. I'm clear that there is, you know, there's a lot of kind of intergenerational transmission in this. We tend to pass this on, whether that's in a gene or whether that's in copied behaviour. You know, I'm not sure I care, really. The fact is that it's in my family. I'd like to think that it ends with me. You know, and that's the gift that I can bring. You know, I have a stepdaughter. I don't have any children of my own, but I have a stepdaughter, and I'll talk a bit about that later. But she knows who I am. She knows where I'm from. She knows what I do. She knows why I do it. She's been to meetings. I mean, it's ruined our using before it starts, frankly. I remember years and years ago, we had a UK convention. We had a T-shirt, which was a bit like a kind of Sex Pistols shirt. It was a map of England, a white T-shirt with a red map of England, and it said Recovery in the UK, like, you know, with letters cut out of a newspaper, like a kind of a Sex Pistols thing. And at the bottom, there was a little box, and it said, Government Health Warning, Narcotics Anonymous can seriously damage your using. And I just thought, it's true. And the number of people I've heard, the number of people who come to rooms like this and get this and then go back out and say they, you know, it's they can't do it, because this ruins it. Because the reason I stopped is because I realised I had a choice. And up until the point I came to a meeting, I had no idea that I had a choice. I just thought this is who I was, you know. So I was little, and I thought everything was my fault. And I was brought up by my mum, who kind of oscillated between kind of cloying codependence and just abandonment, leaving me to do my own thing. No one ever told me to come in. No one ever set any kind of rules around that stuff at home. When I was 11, I went away to a boarding school. It wasn't my fault. And for a long time, I thought that was my fault as well, because it was really a tough place to go. And it was not a normal boarding school. We're not rich. It was a school for people who were clever but didn't have any money. And so I had a governor, someone who was the parent of a previous pupil who paid for my education, and I had to be auditioned in front of these old people and audition, and one of them chose me and paid my school fees to go to this boarding school. It's started in the 15th century, 16th century, this school, it's old. And it was tough because there were some hard people at that school. And I was bullied mercilessly from my first day there because I cried. You know, when someone pushed me and hit me, I cried. And I was a target. And I was bullied incessantly for 8 years there. I was sexually abused. I was tortured. I had a really tough time there. I can say this out loud now because I'm done with that. You know, it wasn't my fault. I'm free of that. I'm the captain of my ship now. I'm free of that. I worked very hard on it. It still draws up emotion in me because it's so fucking unfair that stuff like that can happen to anyone. Not just me, but to anyone. And it wasn't my fault. And the reality is, hurt people hurt people. And I've worked hard at forgiving the people who did the stuff to me that they did to me, because probably wasn't their fault either. You know, I've done some pretty shitty things to people over the years, because bullied people tend to be bullies. And I've worked hard at not being that anymore and taking some responsibility for that and trying really hard not to do it. And every now and then I kind of catch myself, because I'm not, you know, I can talk a great fight, but I've never won a fight in my life. And so I'm not a fighter. But I can be really nasty with my tongue. You know, I can be really cruel to people. And I'm much better now at catching myself at the beginning of that process and stopping it. Because it, you know, people used to do it to me and it's horrible. And I try really hard not to do it now. And I know that I'm not alone in here. You know, people, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of evidence out there. If there's evidence around addiction, talks about this, is a lot of this is about trauma. A lot of the reasons why people come here, you know, become out of control around substances is through trauma. And that's not, you know, it's not too surprising, really. Anyone who comes from a family of addicts is going to experience trauma, right? Duh. And that's my experience. But the reality is, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter why I'm here. It doesn't really matter why I did it. The fact was, I remember when I was in my mid-20s, after this school, because I left this boarding school really traumatised, not really knowing how traumatised I was until it started emerging in my behaviour. I was afraid, but I didn't really realise quite how broken I was until I started trying to make relationships with people. And I used to sit in a pub by the pool table and put my money on the table and play game after game of pool. And my relationships were with people who played pool, because I was quite good at it, so I would keep winning, so I'd keep playing, and, you know, we'd play for drinks, I'd do that for 4 or 5 hours a day. That was how I communicate with people. And then that developed into going around people's houses and starting getting wasted with people and playing Dungeons and Dragons and staying up all weekend. And, you know, I needed substances to stay up all weekend. And that's kind of how my using started. And one day I was with a group of people and I was spouting off like I do. I can speak on any subject with confidence as long as there ain't an expert in a room. And if there's an expert in a room, I'm really in trouble, right? And there happened to be, I was talking about heroin and there was an expert in a room. And they said, you know nothing about what you're talking. And I thought, I'll show you. So I went out and became an expert. So actually I started using my drug of choice on a resentment. And that was just my circumstance. But and the reality is, my drug of choice really was your drugs. If you were mug enough to share your drugs with me, I was your mate. But as soon as yours were gone, I'd go and do mine on my own. I wasn't going to share mine with you. Nah. So my drug career is like anyone's drug career. Maybe my circumstances and my day-to-day events were a bit different. It got more and more chaotic. It got more and more physically abusive. It got more and more dangerous. It got to the point where, you know, I was starting to come in contact with people who were armed. You know, I'd get in the back of a car on the way to collect some drugs and there'd be a gun under the front seat. And it started to get really out of control. I was never a, you know, a hardcore hope to die villain dope fiend. I was just frankly a bit of a wanker. And I lived in a small town in Hertfordshire, and I was a big fish in a small pond. I was the local dealer. And so I had lots of people who I thought were my buddies, but in fact they were just customers, right? And the moment my connection went, everyone ran. And I then had to go and buy drugs from them, and they ripped me off like I'd ripped them off. And money goes far faster than it comes. So my story is the same story as everybody's story. And I reached a point where, in the literature, it describes this really well. It says, we live to use and use to live, very simply, you know. It was all about drugs. It was all about drugs. My conversations were all about, have you got any? Is any good? And can you front it to me until tomorrow? Because I'm definitely going to have some money tomorrow. It's actually ironclad, definite, I'll have it. And I'd, you know, for maybe even for the last couple of years of my using, that was pretty much all my communication with people. I really lived to use and used to live. That was it. Right at the very end, I went to university, and it was a geographical, you know, I kind of moved places to go and live somewhere else, do something completely different. But the problem was, you know, there I was. And the problem's in here, you know, the problem's not out there, it's in here. And I had no idea of a solution, and I was just surviving. I was just, I've heard it eloquently described as not waving but drowning. You know, I was shouting, help, help, and everyone thought I was having a good time. And I ended up at university, and I ended up moving in with my tutor. It seemed a good solution. You know, I'd dictate my essays to her, and she'd write them down, and I'd then copy them out in my handwriting and give them into her to mark. It seemed like a touch, right? And so I got really good marks in my first year. I got top student in my first year, because I was, you know, anyway, it seemed a really good idea. I felt like I'd had a proper result. But it fell apart in the second year. It just fell apart. And as it does, you know, wherever you go, there you are. And so the second year of my university, it just all fell apart. And I just would go in, I'd wear my crash helmet, go in and get my dole check from the little pigeonhole and go and cash it and use. And that was really the only time I ever went to university, was to pick up my gyro. And I remember I got my student grant check, and it was 840 something quid, 1842 quid, and I owed 838 to my dealer. I'd like less than a tenner left after I'd paid him back out of my year's grant check. And I was called into the dean's office at this university in my second year, and I knocked on the door and went in, and I don't know how or why it happened, I just started crying. It felt like this was the point at which everything had reached, you know, this kind of, and I just started crying, and he was on the phone, and he saw my distress and put the phone down, and I told him, I said, I'm a heroin addict and I can't stop and I don't know what to do. And it was a bit like, if you can imagine, I'm on a tin tray sliding down a hill. It's snowing, right? And I'm on a toboggan, right? And a tin tray going down a hill, and it's going too fast, and I'm in trouble, right? And I see a stick sticking out of the ground, and I reach it and I grab it, and I spin around it, and it was like that. That moment in my life, everything spun around that moment, because I said, you know, I reached out and said, I can't do this. And to his absolute credit, he fixed everything. He took the university off my back. He said, take a break, go away, we'll fix it. You can come back when you like. And I had a friend, a girlfriend at university, and she locked me in her house. And we found me a place in an institution, and I went in. And in this institution, I don't know, 2 days in, there was an H&I meeting. And I got it. And I got it in my first meeting, and it was just miraculous, really. There was no kind of bells and whistles and flashing lights. There was no kind of, you know, like ray of light hitting me like, you know, Saul turning into Paul. No Damascene moment. But the fact is, I remember in that first meeting, hearing those readings and thinking, this is me. This is me. And, you know, a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. That's me. And And I it's honestly, it's really hard to remember exactly, but as far as I can remember, I thought in that meeting, or certainly in my earliest days in recovery, I thought, I'm going to have a go at this, because nothing else has worked. You know, I've tried really hard to do a few things. You know, I'd had a job straight after school. I'd gone to drama school. I'd worked as an actor. You know, I tried loads of things. And the fact is, I'd fallen through the first hole in the ground on every single one of them, because I just didn't have enough self-esteem. I didn't have enough of a sense of self to be able to survive a difficulty. So when something was difficult, you know, when I went to an audition and I didn't get it, it just crucified me. They said, well, we loved you, we'll call you Thursday, and they didn't call. And I'd call them Thursday at 4 o'clock, and I go, so, and they go, well, we didn't call you, did we? And that's what it's like, you know, it's a tough old business. And that just killed me. I couldn't do that. And I wanted to, but I couldn't. And my life was really like that. It was like I tried so hard and I couldn't do anything. And the reason I couldn't do anything was because I had no idea who I was. And I was caught in this spiral of you know, self-compulsed fear, self-obsession, and uncontrolled substance use. You know, the fact was that I medicated my feelings, sometimes by drugs, sometimes by behaviour, because I couldn't hold a feeling. I couldn't hold a feeling, couldn't sit with a feeling. So I ran, and I ran all my life from feelings. And I remember when I was a few years in recovery, I remember reading Huckleberry Finn, you know, Tom Sawyer, and he, in one of those, he was bullied, and he turned around and he punched this guy on the nose. And he was never bullied again. And I remember weeping for days, thinking, why did nobody tell me? That's what you do, right? And he was unhappy and he ran away, packed a bag and ran away. And I remember weeping and thinking, I was at this school where I was taught, and it never crossed my mind once, not once, to run away. I just was trapped. And what you have done, you, collectively, NA, because now you represent NA, right, to me, what you did was hold me until I could find myself and stand up and go, I'm going to have a go again. That's what you did, and I thank you for that. And I will thank you forever for that. And that's why I keep coming, because it's not really about me, this. I mean, apart from the fact that everything's about me, this isn't really about me. You know, I don't come... I come for me because I know that if I don't come, I go mad. And actually, if I don't come, my wife says, you need to go to meetings. I do love my wife telling me I need to work my programme. God love her. I mean, she was going to come tonight, and actually, I'm really glad that she went to another meeting because I can talk about her. I wanted to end with a story, and I'm nearly there, and so I will. Really early in my recovery, I got involved in service, and I was less than 30 days clean. I lived in a seaside town. After this, you know, this stint in an institution, they thought I wasn't really ready to go back out onto the street, so they put me in a kind of a, you know, an assisted housing project, where we every day there was someone who came in and, you know, told me what to do, really, because I was pretty institutionalised. And so I did the kind of classic, you know, unemployed, then voluntary work. I picked mushrooms in a mushroom factory. And then I went off to college and learned to be a carpenter. And I've been a carpenter ever since. Take me around the world twice being a carpenter. Get a trade. You get in recovery, get a trade. I mean, if there's any advice I can give anyone, get a trade, right? To take me to 68 countries being a carpenter. I love it, absolutely adore, and I'm useful. I was 30 days clean, and somebody took me to an area meeting. And I'm not one of those people who thinks area meetings are a nightmare. I think they're fascinating and wonderful, and really a beautiful thing. Partly because I get it, partly because I really understand this. I was lucky to get clean just before the World Convention came to, the first time it was outside of America, it came to Wembley in 1986, and I was 86 days clean, and my sponsor wouldn't let me stand up for 90 days. I remember nearly using on that. But it was just a revelation. It was just a revelation to meet people from another country, these Americans. And I sat in the audience next to this guy. I was too afraid to speak to him. And at the clean time countdown, he stood up for like 12 years clean. And I so regretted not talking to him. Just unimaginable clean time. Just unimaginable clean time. I mean, throughout England, that was unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And it opened my eyes to the world of NA, to NA in the world. And I went travelling and went all around the world seeing NA. I don't have time to tell you extraordinary places I've been. You know, the first NA convention in Delhi, the first convention in Calcutta, the first convention in Bangalore. Just wonderful people, places. You know, looking out at the convention room and seeing the Himalayas, just like resting in the sky, and listening to someone telling an NA story behind me. I mean, just miraculous things. You know, quit your job, go travelling. maybe not quit your job, take an oddity, go travelling. But so I got into service, and I loved doing service. And someone then encouraged me to go to the European Convention, and that's another thing. Quit your job, go to the European Convention, Portugal this year. And I went, and I loved it. I met people who I'm still friends with now. And it opened my eyes to another area of the world, but really the world of service in NA. And I got involved in public information service because I've got a big mouth, and I'm quite good at telling stories and describing things and being clear when I speak. And I was elected as the public relations chair of the European delegates. So I would travel around Europe helping them to set up structures and helping them, training them to do public relations talks. And I went to Poland a few times. Right? That's the point of this story. And I went three times in 6 months and to do a training around what public information is, how you'd speak to professionals. And then they did some workshops on it, and then we set one up. So they invited loads of people, and then I went along, and they did a rehearsal. The night before, they had a rehearsal of this presentation, and they invited everyone from NA in this city in Krakow, and they all sat in the audience, and they rehearsed it. They just did it as a rehearsal. It was just wonderful. And when you do a public information presentation, you tend to have someone who does a personal story, a short personal story they tell, like how shit it was, how great it is in NA, and how wonderful their life is now. Right? And the person who did this was this little woman who was like 7 months clean or something. And she had it written down. I mean, it was just so fucking cute. And she just read this. And it was such a great experience to do this. And at the end of this event, I'd spoken to this woman a few times. And as all of you know, newcomers are really dangerous. Right, and the reason newcomers are really dangerous is because they're just so cute. And if you're doing service, you're so important, and they're so excited that you've arrived. I've come from England, and I'm some Charlie Big Spuds come to do this training, and it was like, you know, it's so great. And I'd like to think that's not why I did service, but I think there must have been an element of that, if I'm entirely honest. The actor in me came out. And anyway, she said to me, you know, it's really nice to meet you. And I said, well, maybe one day we'll meet again. And about 9 years later, she friended me on Facebook. And in July is our fourth wedding anniversary. Oh. And so I want to make it clear, this is not a dating agency. And it really shouldn't be. Although the literature does not once mention relationships about, you know, what it says is it's important that you don't make any important decisions in your first year of recovery. That's anything it says. That's the get out. But but anyway, so we started talking, and I went out and we started courting, and she had a daughter who was then 12 and monosyllabic and on the kind of autistic spectrum, and really right at the beginning of it, but just so afraid to even look at me, right? And I really understand that. You know, her dad is still out there using, and you know, she was a really traumatized young woman. And And she's 18 now, and she lives with us. And last night we talk now. We have an extraordinary, a relationship that just fills me with love. I never thought I wanted kids, and I'm now starting to wish I had. But I feel like I've made up for it with her, because I've been entrusted with showing her that there are men who can be trusted, and that men are all right, and you can speak to people and you'll get a trustworthy answer, and I'll protect her with my life. And I love that. I love that. And I've learned a lot about how crappy I was as a man by being around women, and I'm better at it now. This story, right? When I was travelling, I was out in Thailand, and I wear proudly an NA symbol around my neck. I've done since really early on. I bought a silver one because I couldn't afford a gold one, and then one day I could afford a gold one, I bought a gold one. And I've worn it ever since. And I was travelling with this young Swedish girl, as you do. She had a motorbike crash. So she had to stay in one place to go to the hospital. And I kept moving. And if you've ever been travelling, what you meet people and then you kind of go on, and they're like clouds passing in the sky, man. So I carried on. But I told her my story. She asked me what it was, and I told her about NA, and I told her what it meant. I told her about the symbol. And we made an arrangement to meet in this restaurant in Bangkok, 2 months later. And the reality is, I think I probably liked her a lot more than she liked me. And I was like a bit older, rough, right? And she was lovely. I was in this restaurant a day early, hoping she'd be there, right? And this restaurant, for any of you who know, it's in Khao San Road. It's got a wall covered in messages. It's a famous place where people meet who are travelling. And I'm scanning this wall, and I see an NA symbol and Simon. I think she's here. And I opened this note, and it was from someone called Connor, right? And Connor was on a relapse in the south of Thailand on a bus, and this cute little Swedish girl said, "I know what that symbol you're wearing around your neck means." And she told him about me and that we'd arranged to meet, and he turned around and came back up to Bangkok and met me, and we had a meeting, and he's been clean ever since. And I used to tell that story, and I never used to use his name because I've lost touch with him, and I never asked his permission to use his name. And I was telling this story. I went to the Ukraine last year, to Kiev, to their convention. I spoke at their convention. I told this story. And someone from the World Board happened to be there doing some workshops. And as we were leaving, they said, "His name wasn't Connor, was it, by any chance?" And I said, "Yeah, it was." And they showed me their phone. And the last text on their phone was from Connor. And Connor had 12-stepped this woman into recovery. And this woman was my wife's sponsor. So my wife's sponsor was 12-step by that. And you can't write this stuff. You couldn't write this stuff. And it's like miracle upon miracle upon miracle. And all you've got to do is keep coming back, you know? All you've got to do is keep coming back. And as they say in London, the rest is gravy. And the reality is, the rest is gravy. Because if you keep coming back, this will work on you. It don't matter how many times you use, just stay alive and keep coming back. Because we will hold you until you can stand up and do it for yourself. We will. We promise. There's nearly 70,000 NA meetings in the world right now. A week. 68,700 was the last number, so it's going to be the fat of 70,000 in 120 something countries around the world, right? So if you put in time zones and all that kind of stuff, that means that pretty much every second of every minute of every hour of every day, people are holding hands and saying the Serenity Prayer. Just think about that. Everywhere, every second, people are doing it. Every second. So if you're having a bad day, right, you're on your own, and you don't think you can do this anymore, remember, someone somewhere, every second of every minute of every hour of every day, is saying the Serenity Prayer for you. Right? And at the end of this meeting, when we have a moment's silence and we say the Serenity Prayer, say it for them. Thanks for listening.